Hello and welcome back to Goodness Lover Live. Today we're talking to hormone expert and author Dr. Marisa Snyder, and she's going to tell us all there is to know about estrogen dominance. Let's dive in. Dr. Marisa Snyder, we are so privileged to be with you today talking all about estrogen dominance. What a funny little topic. How are you today? Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I am doing great today, and I love talking about estrogen dominance. So it's perfect for us to have this conversation.
Awesome. I didn't know about estrogen dominance for quite some time, even well into my health journey. And I think I was really missing out on an important piece of information, because I think a lot of people, women and men included, often have symptoms of estrogen dominance and don't even know that that's something they should be looking into. So maybe to start off with, could you tell us what someone might be experiencing if they have an issue with estrogen dominance?
Absolutely. When I see it mostly in women, but not men can absolutely have it as well. So I'm going to give kind of a run through of a lot of the symptoms. One, decreased sex drive can play a role here. Irregular or abnormal menstrual periods, bloating, constipation, breast swelling and tenderness, fibrocystic breasts. So they feel really kind of just fibrous. Headaches, especially migraines right before your period or during your period. Mood swings, so irritability and depression can show up. Weight gain, especially around the abdomen, hips, and thighs, so kind of that visceral belly fat. Cold hands and feet, and this is because estrogen dominance can play a role and work synergistically with thyroid issues. And so we may see, if we start to see low thyroid function, it's worth looking to see what's going on with your estrogen levels. Hair loss or brittle hair, a sluggish metabolism, brain fog, PMS, and trouble sleeping. So those are kind of the telltale signs that we'll see when estrogen is unopposed and a little out of control.
And then for the fellas, is there anything in particular?
I'm not sure. Fellas.
The men.
Definitely. It's a very Australian saying.
Breast swelling as well. You'll see a little bit more fat deposits there. Again, estrogen is a proliferative growth hormone. So you think of growth. Men may see, maybe they'll have like a bigger booty, maybe more fat around the midsection. Migraines as well. We'll see that with men. Constipation, bloating, gas. Those will be playing a role. Potentially decreased sex drive, but probably not until like their 40s.
Wow. So there's a lot of unappealing symptoms that you've just listed off here. Tell me, Dr. Marisa, have you experienced this in your life before? And if so, when did you discover that it was an estrogen problem?
Absolutely. Yeah, I have. It was in my, I would say, mid to late 30s, probably 36, 37. And kind of the telltale signs for me, because estrogen dominance can happen. Like one month you could be good, the next month it shows up. And so usually when I had a really big deadline, you know, a couple of months of really working hard and kind of letting things go to the wayside, that next period was a monster. Like it was coming for me. So usually my periods would start with a migraine. That was always a telltale sign for me that estrogen was unopposed there. I would ultimately start to feel fibrocystic breast. I'd start to feel more bloated, but really severe PMS symptoms was always a sign for me that things weren't right. And if that happens more consistently, you will definitely see it on labs in particular.
Okay.
But luckily we can absolutely get this under control. So that's a good thing. And so, once, you know, in the beginning, a lot of us as women, we kind of just write it off as, oh, it's just a bad period, or, oh, this, you know, this is just PMS symptoms. But if you start to really dial in and take a look at those types of symptoms, you know, menstrual pain, migraine, severe bloating, fibrocystic breast, these aren't normal things. They may be common, but they're definitely not normal. And we really want to be, you know, more mindful of what could potentially happen if estrogen over time gets unopposed. We see things like uterine fibroids, maybe even ovarian cancer, prostate cancer in men, breast cancer in women. We start to see aging happening a little bit quicker. So those are the kind of the longer standing issues that happen if we continue to let estrogen go unopposed in the body.
Excellent. So you're saying something interesting there, let it go unopposed. So is there some way of dealing with this problem?
Absolutely. Well, the reason why I say unopposed is technically estrogen is dominant for women specifically in the first 2 weeks of their cycle, right? During the follicular phase. So estrogen's doing its thing in the follicular phase. Then what I call the main event, which is ovulation, happens. Some, you know, women around day 14, day 16, you know, depending on what your cycle lands in. And after we ovulate, we then have a corpus luteum, and that corpus luteum will then release progesterone, and progesterone becomes the dominant hormone in the luteal phase. And so when I say unopposed, it's oftentimes when either progesterone is lowered, either because there's an ovulatory cycle, a cycle without ovulation, or we have a decrease in progesterone due to things like chronic stress, or due to things like trauma where progesterone is getting decreased. And when progesterone is not there to create that beautiful dance or that beautiful seesaw, then estrogen is doing her or doing him, unopposed. So that's what I mean, is that that dance isn't happening, which is meant to be happening throughout our cycles.
Mm. So if you could give us a quick overview of the difference between estrogen and progesterone, and of course you just said they're meant to be in harmony, I guess that kind of yin and yang idea. What is an overview of those two different hormones?
Specifically, so estrogen, the goal for estrogen is to help get our bodies, if we're talking about women, helping to get our bodies ready. So it's kind of, you think about the uterus as being the garden of the whole situation. So estrogen is ensuring that we are building up that epithelial endometrium layer. So we've got all the blood supply and everything for when we get pregnant. That's the goal, right? Every month we're preparing to get pregnant. Then we have that ovulatory situation where we, the main event, and then progesterone comes out. And progesterone, the number one goal for progesterone is to maintain that pregnancy. So if the pregnancy does happen, we're just gonna say that it did until we get to the point of the start of our new menstrual cycle. And there are definitely other roles in which progesterone and estrogen play. Estrogen is phenomenal for mental acuity, mental focus. It's great for growth. It's great for bone growth, reproductive growth. It is amazing for helping to keep us happy. So estrogen plays a lot of different roles inside of the body. And then progesterone is definitely that calming hormone. So we always think about kind of calming down things like anxiety. But its main job and responsibility is to maintain that pregnancy.
Thank you for that overview. Okay, so we've discovered that the end result of estrogen dominance is not appealing. But what about, like, how is this happening in the first place? How are we getting so imbalanced as men and women, if you can put it together?
Absolutely. Such a great question. There's actually a couple different ways that this happens. The first way is that there's actually three different types of estrogen inside of the body. It's estrone, estradiol, and estriol. And what we find is if estrone and estradiol, estrone being the second most common estrogen, a weaker type, but definitely in the environment, estradiol kind of the most potent version, definitely supporting bone growth, serotonin levels, memory, heart health, the things that I mentioned earlier. When these two become, they're more proliferative, and if they become more dominant inside of the body, whether it's because our liver isn't functioning properly, or we are the dance between progesterone and estrogen isn't happening, we have a situation where we can have estrogen dominance. The other place where we start to see problems is through estrogen metabolites. If for some reason the liver, through phase one and phase two liver detoxification, is not breaking down estrogen appropriately, it goes down the wrong pathway. I can absolutely go deeper into the pathways in just a moment. Ultimately, we have a buildup of those metabolites. They're not able to be packaged in the gut through our estrobolome. Phase three detoxification is in the gut, and then they get recirculated back into the liver where it becomes a bigger burden. So that is the one of the other ways. And then the other one, which is that relationship between estrogen and progesterone. If for whatever reason, progesterone is just not where it needs to be, and those can be separate concerns and issues, which we can address, then estrogen, just by default, even if you have low estrogen, it can still be more dominant than progesterone. And we do definitely have an issue inside of the body.
Excellent.
Okay, thank you.
I'm very curious, is this trajectory of estrogen dominance on the rise, or is there an like a sudden increase? What have you seen like at a clinical level, and is there something going on at, like, I guess at a peer review level?
Definitely. On a clinical level, it's definitely on the rise. And there's a couple reasons externally why we're seeing that. But also kind of just how you said earlier, Sarah, how you just didn't know about it. I think a lot of people didn't know about it. We kind of just kind of ignored it, and we kind of chalked it up to a common symptom. So naturally, when women go into perimenopause, which is around, I mean, it feels like it's coming on earlier and earlier. And kind of the earliest we usually see perimenopause is around 35 years old. But let's say 3 decades ago, that was still not very common. We were seeing it closer to like 39, 40. So we're seeing it earlier. That has a lot to do with chronic stress. That has a lot to do with trauma. That has a lot to do with environmental stressors, environmental toxins. And that's just bringing that barrier down a little bit sooner. But in general, when women are heading into perimenopause, the first hormone to start to decrease gradually is progesterone. So just naturally, women in their 40s are going to see an uptick in estrogen kind of naturally. As progesterone begins to drop slowly over time as we get towards menopause, estrogen is still up for a while, but then starts to have that roller coaster effect where it's up 1 month and then it just plummets the next. And that inconsistency oftentimes is driving estrogen dominance as well in women in their late 30s and their 40s. And that's why we see a lot of women having fibroids in their 40s heading into menopause. We start to see a higher uptick in either complete hysterectomies or partial hysterectomies in our 40s as well, because usually those fibroids, if they become symptomatic, if they become we start to see symptoms around our fibroids, bleeding, pain, discomfort. Maybe they're becoming very, very large in size that they're actually visible to see. Those are times where doctors are looking at more surgical methods for managing that. However, very rarely are we looking at the cause of the problem, which is actually the estrogen dominance. That's what's driving those fibroids to be created in the first place.
I'm curious, with you mentioned a toxicity level, like some, mm-hmm. A concept around that. Can you elaborate further on that? Because it's something we certainly discovered that was very curious when we were creating our series, The Healing Key. So yeah, I'd love for you to elaborate on that.
Absolutely. So environmental toxins, xenoestrogens are proliferative in their own right. They're everywhere. They're in chemical compounds, they're in parabens, solvents, they're in obesogens, which is my least favorite type of xenoestrogen, literally says what it does, and it makes you obese. It throws off ghrelin and leptin. So we see these things in persistent organic pollutants, things like cleaners, Glade plug-ins, plastic bottles, vinyl, your flip-flops, your receipts at your grocery store, makeup, nail polish, mascara. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the things that women in particular, and men too, I mean, men are definitely wearing flip-flops and are cleaning, but a lot of the personal care products that women are touching or consuming on a day-to-day basis, unfortunately, have these parabens, these BPA, these persistent organic pollutants. And the thing about persistent organic pollutants is they're exactly that. They're persistent. And so they could stay in the body up to a decade being stored in our adipose tissue, our fat tissue. So one of the biggest issues when it comes to estrogen dominance, and I think just hormonal imbalance in general and liver issues, is that, you know, we're unconsciously being exposed to these xenoestrogens, and they're building up over time.
It's wild. Whenever I'm at the shops now and I know that what a receipt can do to me, I'm like, she's like, do you want the receipt? And sometimes I need the receipt. Mostly I'm like, no, I'm fine. But I'm just like, we're like, who's going to take the fall today?
Yeah,
who's
going to pick up the receipt? I guess I'm less sensitive, so the male takes the receipt. I'm like, I'll have that BPA, thank you.
Yes, I will take the BPA receipt.
He takes one for the team, thanks, honey.
Yeah, it's scary. Like, think about the candles and the plug-ins and the Glade plug-ins and all the things that we think, all the fragrances out there. It's just adding up, you know. And so a big part of, you know, we talk about like environmentally how we clean up hormone issues, especially around estrogen, is really doing a major home detox, you know, taking a real scrutinizing look at what you're using every single day and slowly begin to remove those things so it doesn't feel super overwhelming. But our house is, I mean, I'm sure there's a few things that we haven't considered, but this house has been swiped multiple times for any type of estrogen-driven products.
That's great.
I'm curious with if we just dive into this mechanism, because I find it fascinating with what happens with these xenoestrogens. So what's happening in the body? Is it looking at these xenoestrogens as part of the, I guess, the team, or does the body recognize it?
Yeah, the body thinks it's a part of the team. And so basically the concept is that we have these receptor sites, and for the body, estrogen receptor sites are on many, many cells in the body, kind of like thyroid receptor sites. You know, it's one of those things where we just use a lot of this particular hormone for growth, for gene expression. And so what happens with they're not as strong by any means as estradiol or estrone at all, but they're plentiful. There's a ton of them, and they stay in the system way longer. It's the thing about estrogen is you got to use it and lose it. It's not supposed to stay in the body. You got to keep it moving. So we're detoxifying and we're neutralizing estrogen all the time, 24/7. Like, your liver doesn't just have a designated from 2 to 4, it's estrogen detoxification time. No, it's constant 24/7. We've got to get this hormone out. And so when you've got these proliferative hormones, even though they're weaker, that receptor is binding to those receptor sites and it's jamming the lock. And in some instances, we have receptor sites where estrogen fits in and then progesterone fits in. But if the xenoestrogen comes in and blocks the lock, now progesterone can't actually get into that lock. And so when you've got a situation where you've got these kind of negative, unopposed external estrogens that are doing harm, you're basically running the genetic expression of whatever that proliferative hormone is doing unopposed, when it's not even supposed to be doing that. And that's where we start to see the proliferation of things like cancers or things like fibroids.
Wow. Thank you for sharing. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned before that you've done a few clean sweeps through your house to make sure all your products are not having any of these offenders in there. For our viewers, what are some top tips of what to look for to avoid hormonal disruptors?
Such a great question. I mean, a lot of things, again, like fragrance, BPA, and there's a huge long list of things. I think what I would recommend is what would we be looking for in terms of looking for a natural product. And one of the things I always love to get people to start on is cleaning products, because I find that the majority of cleaning products in your everyday hardware store or drugstore or big store, they're guaranteed that product is not going to serve you in terms of your hormones. Whether it is an endocrine disruptor or a neurodisruptor, you're going to have issues. And so you're looking for products that are free of phthalates, free of solvents, free of parabens, free of sulfites, and free of fragrances, but that they're organic, they're green. And ultimately, a lot of our cleaning products can be made with just a couple different ingredients. Things like vinegar, distilled water, kosher salt, essential oils can be phenomenal as well because they're antimicrobial, and baking soda. Honestly, you can make over almost every cleaning product that you have with those five ingredients. I think that's a great first place to start. And then, when it comes to makeup, that's a whole nother ball game. I think using a site like the Environmental Working Group as a way of grading certain makeup, because it all looks like a foreign language to most people, and it can be really difficult to decipher. Like, I think about sugar as an example. Like, there's 30 different ways, 30 different names for sugar, dextrose, maltose. You think about all of that. And the average person, just when they look at that label, they're not necessarily always going to know. So I think it's important to, like, if you love a certain makeup brand or you love a certain type of personal care brand, definitely look into the environmental working group, see how it's graded, and see if it's worthwhile for keeping. And the beautiful thing is today is, thank goodness for the internet and for research, you know, there's a lot of great beauty supply products now today and makeup companies that are really working very hard to create green product line, organic product lines that do not disrupt our hormones or our endocrine system. And they pride themselves on showing you the research. So I would definitely just kind of, you know, even Googling top 10 best, you know, clean makeup brands or top 5 best, you know, skincare brands that are not using chemicals and seeing what that research looks like.
Great tips. Thank you.
So good. And I think it's such an important thing that people just take this into their own hands, because if you're sitting around waiting for the government to tell us that these things are bad or they're good or whatnot, it's just not going to happen. There's way too much money at the top level of government that is influencing certain, you know, I guess, song and dances that are going on there of like, this is fine. Now we're going to create a variant of this. So definitely educate yourself. Do not, you know, and this should be a consumer-led thing that we drive, because as the power of consumers, we can change markets. So definitely get on board and spread this message. I'm curious, as we transition out of sort of these external toxins, there's one massive contributor that could potentially be disrupting someone's hormones, and that's called stress. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, we're in a very stressful environment right now. So can you just explain to us why stress disrupts our hormones, particularly estrogen, and what we can obviously do about that?
Absolutely. So, and stress can come in a lot of forms. We were talking about the toxins. That's definitely a stressor on the body. Anything that the body's having to manage and having to combat is definitely a stressor. But the stressor I think we're both talking about is the perceived stress, the ever looming stress of, we just don't know what tomorrow is going to look like. The fear of what this virus is doing. Whether our kids going to get go back to school or not? Do I need to become a third grade teacher tomorrow? You know, all of these things are the types of stresses that I think are popping up for parents and adults alike. And what we know about stress and perceived or real stress, it doesn't really matter. The body just processes it the same way, is that, you know, we're perceiving stress not only inside of our limbic system, which is the survival part of the brain, but we're also perceiving stress really on our skin cells, our cells inside of the body. So a lot of our body is always perceiving kind of that stranger danger situation. But when we look at the how the hormone system works specifically, we're looking at the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. And it works in conjunction with the sympathetic nervous system. Now, these are two very different systems, but they work together. I want to focus specifically on the hormone system. So when I receive a perceived stress, let's say my mama texts me right now, there's an emergency in the family and everything, just epinephrine, norepinephrine, two of the faster acute stress hormones, they fire. And then in order for me to sustain that amount of handling the situation, cortisol comes into play and it's a more long standing stress hormone. That information goes from the limbic system, communicates to the pituitary gland, and then heads to the adrenals, where the adrenals sends out those appropriate messages. And because our bodies are hardwired for survival more than anything, at the end of the day, you know, if you're not living, you can't make babies. So what's the point of making babies anyway if you got to survive? And so our bodies are always going to favor survival over the digestive system, over the reproductive system. It stops making progesterone and starts making more cortisol to manage that longstanding issue. And these could be any kind of triggers. This could just you feeling overcommitted, or you're feeling overscheduled, or you don't know what's going to happen next. All of that just kind of adds and compounds to the problem. And as we talked about earlier, if we have a decrease in progesterone for whatever reason, whether it's stress or whether it's trauma, trauma does the same thing. Trauma can absolutely trigger more perceived stress. We now have a situation where we've decreased our amount of progesterone in sacrifice for something else, for survival. And estrogen is still just doing what estrogen's doing over here. That's where we have a situation where we have unopposed estrogen again in the body. So if stress is constant and consistent, we're always going to be kind of playing, it's always going to be a situation where progesterone may be lower than normal. And that's so often what we see in so many tests, especially the Dutch test, where we look at progesterones and progesterone metabolites. We look at how cortisol is being leveraged and utilized inside of the body. It's really obvious when we see a deregulation of cortisol that we will see a decrease in progesterone. So it's usually very, very common situation. And probably one of the things that I see the most on hormone labs for women is that combination.
I'm very curious to hear about this, because I'm sure a lot of people listening right now will be like, I've got estrogen dominance. I have X, Y, and Z.
So, I think most of us do right now.
So can you take us through some of the testing regimes that you think are the most effective, and also maybe some case studies as to what happens, what are some before and afters that we can look
at? Absolutely. So, when we're looking at the full kit and caboodle picture, we want to see everything. We don't want to just see cortisol on its own. We don't want to just see progesterone on its own or DHEA on its own. I don't want to just see what's going on with estradiol or estrone. I want to see what is happening within the metabolites. Like, how is estrone being broken down? Is it going down the right pathway? Is it going down what we call the 2OH pathway, the safest pathway to get packaged up in the gut to then get sent out? Or are we seeing it go down the 4OH pathway, which is the where we see more cancer happening, or the 16OH pathway, which we really see a lot more estrogen dominance? That's the proliferative pathway where we'll see more fibroids, we'll see fibrocystic breasts, we'll see migraines, we'll see symptoms of estrogen dominance. So it's important for us to know what's actually going on with estrogen and how it's metabolized. And so the test that I recommend is the Dutch test, and it's looking at dried urine metabolites for all of these hormones so that we can see the full landscape. So it's really the only test I recommend if we're looking at the full kit and caboodle. And the great thing about the Dutch test is that you can do it at home. And so you don't need to have it ordered by your doctor. You definitely need someone to read it, because it's not an easy test to read. It's very complicated. But what I love about the company is that they will refer a doctor to you, or they'll have someone read the test for you, because they know that so often women are not getting, like, a test like this is just not getting approved. Like, if I were to go to my medical doctor, my general doctor at the hospital, I'd have to beg and plead often to just even get basic labs run, just total estrogen, total progesterone, maybe total cortisol, who knows what they're willing to do. But it would really give me, and they would even say, honestly, this is going to tell us much. And it really wouldn't. And they would be right on that. And so we would need a test that really can follow us through the whole path to tell us, okay, that's where that's lower. That's possibly the reason for it. We can start to put together all the different puzzle pieces and see the full map.
Excellent. Right. So what are some stories, a case study? Yeah, I would love absolutely to hear a case study.
So, and I've got so many case studies. Unfortunately, case studies where things have, like, I'm working with women after the fact, after they've gone through the whole rigmarole. And then I've worked with women where we start to see things like, severe PMS symptoms. Maybe their luteal cycle just shortened a little bit. And they're having migraines, or they've all of a sudden their bleeding is just getting a little bit more inconsistent and heavier. And the first thing, anytime I hear any of those symptoms, I usually look at age. This particular woman, her name was Sandra. She was 37 years old. And immediately I was like, oh girl, that's estrogen dominance. And so the first thing I always want to work on is, number one, what's going on with your stress levels? What's happening on the day to day? And then bring in some mindfulness exercise, things like meditation or breathing, 6 breaths in, 6 breaths out. Having a little chime on her phone where she can actually grab her little essential oil, take a little break on the hour so things don't build up and get a little bit crazy. So managing stress in that way, kind of as a preventative role, because honestly, stress is always going to get the best of us. There's no amount of things happening in the world. There's no amount of obligations that you've got going on. It's how we're managing and setting the tone for the day that we want. So worked with her on that, got that locked and loaded, because you could drink all the green smoothies, you could eat all the kale salads, you could take all the choline and methylated B vitamins in the world to clean up your liver. And if you're still running on hyperdrive over here, we're still going to see a situation where you still have estrogen unopposed. So we got to kind of tackle it from a couple of places. Then usually what I see with women, Sandra in particular, is she, when we ran full complete blood panel, folate was low, B12 was low. So for me, I wanted to get her on a methylated B vitamin. A lot of us, in terms of our genetics, we don't necessarily know what's going on. And so always having an activated or methylated vitamin so that we're dealing with a potential, I didn't know Sandra had an MTHFR or a COMT gene mutation. So an activated B vitamin is always my preference. I take one every single day. And then also I bumped up her choline and made sure we were, she was getting all of the necessary essential antioxidants, glutathione, resveratrol to support her detoxification pathways. And then looking at food. So I always want to clean up the liver, because the liver is doing so many jobs, including filtering blood, storing hormones, manufacturing, converting, neutralizing hormones, storing vitamins. I mean, there's so much that the liver is doing 24/7 for us. And I rarely meet someone who doesn't need a little liver upgrade. So making sure that Sandra was drinking a glass of water with lemon juice every morning before she kind of got started with her day, making sure that we incorporated healthy foods like green smoothies, lots of cruciferous vegetables, adding broccoli sprouts to her smoothie, just really doing a lot of things that we could do to support the liver. Again, making sure that she was on choline, B vitamins, glutathione, selenium, the types of supplements that are going to help to support our liver detoxification pathways. And so after just a couple of months of implementing these strategies, mostly lifestyle strategies, a little bit of supplementation and making a couple of food modifications, all of a sudden her periods became more consistent. She gained a couple of days on her cycle. Now she was running at, instead of 26, she was running at 28. And she was also, migraines gone, breast didn't feel like just lumpy, uncomfortable breast. And she just felt better. She had more energy. And so what I love so much is that if we can assist the body, we can assist the liver, and we can lower those stress levels, your body so badly wants to be back on track. It so badly wants to be running, like a fine-tuned machine. And so it just took a couple of months. I'd say 60 days and you can turn the whole ship around.
So good. Good. Thank you for sharing. And I have a question. Where does the gut fit into all of this? As you probably know, we're pretty obsessed with the gut. And I do know that it has a hormonal it impacts the hormonal system. So could you tell us, do you incorporate gut health protocols in with your clients?
Absolutely. So anytime I have someone showing up, this was something where I just knew, for instance, with Sandra, not a lot of changes were necessary, but sometimes I have women, another woman, Mary, where it's not very clear. Clearly the gut and the liver are both being affected, whether we're dealing with a leaky gut or we're dealing with some type of microbiome imbalance. And the estrobolome plays a huge, huge role. So again, the liver neutralizes, gets it into a water-soluble state, gets our estrogen into a water-soluble state. And then the liver's like, I'm done. Gut, it's your job. It's your turn. And if for some reason our gut microbiome isn't fully flourishing, it's not happy, for some reason the estrobolome has been compromised, we're going to have an issue with the packaging and removal. Also, if we have women and men that are struggling with constipation, best believe all that work that your liver and your gut just did, it's going to get recirculated again. And so something to just be mindful of. So if I'm looking at potentially a gut concern as well, which in most people that's very much the case, it is time to bring out the big guns and start to look at more serious food intolerances. So removing things like all dairy, eggs have got to go, sugar's got to go, just kind of cleaning the slate, making sure that we've got a good probiotics, good prebiotics, good digestive enzymes. Honestly, I don't think that there is an adult on this planet who does not need a digestive enzyme. I am so pro digestive enzymes. And then also making sure that they've got enough acid in their gut, in their stomach, to actually digest and break down the proteins, that their bile is working properly. So all of those things need to be looked at and considered as well. when we're just looking at the overall state of hormonal imbalance and gut issues. And so those are the types of modifications and changes I'll bring in if I've got to kind of bring in the bigger guns.
Wonderful.
Awesome. Yeah. As just before we wrap up, I just have one last question just for the males listening. If you're still this far, guys, we do have estrogen dominance. So I'm glad that you've made it this far. can you explain to us a little bit, just is there a different protocol for men when you're dealing with this in a male, for example?
Absolutely. When it comes to the liver and the gut, it's the same for both parties. I mean, I think that, again, men too. And, you know, some of the big no-brainers with the liver is be mindful of your medications. Be mindful of your acetaminophen, your painkillers, your natural anti-inflammatory steroids. You know, you got to just be mindful. The liver is having to break that down, process that. And when we take things like acetaminophen, it actually cripples the pathway that breaks it down. So it's really interesting, that whole pathway. Also alcohol. And I know alcohol is at an all-time high right now. At least in the US, it's definitely, you know, I used to live in the Bay Area and I remember, which is San Francisco Bay Area. And San Francisco in COVID had a 40% uptick in alcohol consumption, even with all of the bars being closed. And San Francisco has, like, per capita, some of the most, like the most bars per capita of many cities. And those are shut down. And yet the consumption was up a 40 extra percent. And so definitely cause for concern there. So even things like, you know, watching your alcohol intake, watching the amount of medications, you know, especially over-the-counter medications that you're taking, are going to play a huge role. Incorporating things like, you know, more cruciferous vegetables, making sure that you've got a great daily vitamin that you're taking, that you're being mindful of taking choline, that you're boosting your antioxidant levels like glutathione. You know, all of this is a benefit. My husband is on choline. He's on glutathione. He manages, you know, he definitely has major no alcohol breaks. He doesn't take any medications. But Alex, anytime I'm doing a liver reset, my husband is always doing the liver reset with me. You know, I like to do, I call it the liver spit shine. Like, I like to get a new liver. And so, and it makes a massive difference in Alex. Just energy levels, sleep, digestion, all of it is a huge, huge win. So for men, it's 100% important to reset the liver, make sure those pathways are working properly, and help to support your gut. Because whether you're a man or a woman, estrogen is being processed and broken down and neutralized the same way.
And despite what you might see on those commercials, guys, drinking all that beer isn't necessarily going to make you more testosterone. Manly.
Yes, zero favors, especially if you've got a gluten issue. My husband definitely has a gluten issue. And every now and again, he picks up a beer and I'm like, what are you doing? Like, he just, like, you can tell when someone, just blows up. You know, and I'm just like, that's coming for you hard, like in the next 12 hours. You know, I do not mince words when it comes to something that I know is going to obliterate my husband.
This is sounding very familiar. I can't understand why.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Marisa. We found this so insightful, and you have a great knack of explaining things in a really clear and concise way. There's so much to explore here. I'm sure our viewers will go into a Googling frenzy to learn more about all the awesome things that you've shared with us today. But for anyone that is watching and wants to connect with Dr. Marisa further, so your podcast, Dr. Marisa, can you tell us a little bit about that and what sort of topics you cover on Essentially You?
Absolutely. So Essentially You, it really does focus on women's hormone health. However, we cover a lot of topics. I talk a lot about the liver on the podcast and gut health, but I also talk about estrogen dominance, PCOS, you know, the perimenopausal spectrum is what I like to call it, because it can look all kinds of ways for all kinds of people. But there's a lot of episodes that do benefit men as well, but it definitely is centered around the ladies.
Awesome. So, and for anyone that wants to follow you on Instagram, Dr. Marisa, it's at Dr. Marisa, right?
Yeah, at Dr. Okay. Marisa, DrMariza. Yeah.
Perfect. Awesome. Well, thank you again for joining us. We've loved it. And everyone in the world, stay safe where you are. The world's a little bit crazy at the moment, but I definitely recommend that you take on Dr. Marisa's advice with lowering stress. I thought those rituals sounded wonderful. So lots to learn there and lots to implement. Thank you so much, Dr. Marisa.
Thank you.